Emergency. Batman speaking. Warning all of you to brace yourselves for big news.
The biggest.
Tell them, Robin.
Holy superlatives, Batman! It's really exciting.
Greetings, citizens. Join me, your old bat chum, John S. Drew, on my journey to discover what it is I love about the classic 1966 Batman television series on the Batcave podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by a guest host as we review the classic television series. There's a new episode every 2 weeks. Same bat time, same bat channel on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at thebatcavepodcast.com.
Holy memoranda, folks! Make a note not to miss it.
Good thinking, Robin.
Hi, this is Gordy Hoffman from the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition, and you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to 2015 and episode 24 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you could find on iTunes or the link below. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts putting the culture in pop culture over at chronicrift.com. Very excited to kick off the new year this way. I want to just throw something out real quick. As you guys are going to be hearing, there's going to be a fair amount of bumpers and advertisements and stuff like that for other shows and other podcasts. But I just want to throw a reminder out here that this entire show is completely nonprofit. I'm not making a dime. Nobody's making a dime by coming on the show. Everybody's just sharing stuff, sharing their insights and their stories out of their good graces and just wanting to spread some good advice, some good wisdom, and help some folks out. So I'm not making a buck. In fact, I've lost a couple bucks on this. But those advertisements and stuff you hear are literally just us podcasters helping each other out. I am very fortunate to know two super, super talented DJs. And I kicked this whole show off with Matt the Cat. And when I had to kick off 2015, I immediately thought of another super talented DJ, by the name of Dan Mason, who is currently the operations manager of several radio stations down in Tampa. And I figure this is a great way to kick off the new year talking about the world of radio and all the creativity and all the thing that goes into it. Welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Dan Mason.
Hey, buddy. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, one of the things I love talking about radio because it's not the little engine that could, it's the beast that just won't die. And we're seeing, it's probably the one medium that has changed more. You know, everyone talks about, oh, internet has changed TV and movies and all that. But like, you know, radio has been through so many changes in the past 10 years, maybe even just in the past 5 years. And I'm just, would love to start off with talking about, you know, how is radio surviving and where do you see radio going in the 21st century?
No, it's funny. I mean, you know, you mentioned our mutual friend, Matt the Cat, mm-hmm. who was very successful at XM radio for many years.
Yeah, prime
and
time.
I remember, like, 2004, I was working in Cleveland, and I remember talking to Matty. He's like, dude, terrestrial radio is dying. This is the future. You got to come here. And, you know, here we are 10 years later, and, you know, we're still around. And then really, as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, people are like, dude, Pandora's coming. And this is going to be the end of terrestrial radio. But 2015 is now here, and Pandora is still not a profitable business model.
Yeah.
And radio continues to move along. I think there's a lot of reasons that we're still here. Number one, I think, is just access and equipment. I mean, there are so many installed radio units. If you think between cars and just tabletop units and mm-hmm. You know, there are 2 billion radios right now in North America, and not radio stations, but actual just physical radio units. So they're easy. They're easy to use. They're free. Nobody's asking you to put in a credit card number to utilize us. So there is a simplicity on that front. But I think, moreover, when radio is done right, and you can argue that in the age of big corporate radio, we're doing it right less often. But when radio is done right, I don't think that there is any more intimate personal medium that exists. You know, if you're watching Anderson Cooper on television, Anderson Cooper is talking to millions of viewers. He's not really talking directly to you. If you watch Jimmy Fallon, he's really great. if you had watched Jay Leno before him, he was really great, but Jay wasn't really talking directly to you. And I think when the torch was finally passed and Jay moved on, sure, some people were sad, but they kind of got right in with Jimmy Fallon, and they were down with what he was doing, and everybody just, you know, nobody really talks about Leno now. But radio over the course of my career has always been great at that call to action. When there is a issue in the community and you think of those definitive moments, I remember being on the air for 9/11.
I was just going to bring that story up. Yeah, I remember you talking about that. Sorry, go ahead.
I remember being on air more recently and programming radio in Boston during the marathon bombing. And radio is still that place where people were tune into to connect with their community and to grieve and talk about the issue of the day. And sometimes it's as simple as the construction that's crippled the traffic in LA on the morning commute. And sometimes it can be a national tragedy. But when we do it right and we can rally the community, I think it's that connection is unparalleled in media.
Yeah, because there is that local feel to it, isn't it? And I think that's something that's almost an understated quality of radio. We're a household of radio listeners ourselves. I, full disclosure, listen mostly to sports radio, but the sports radio here in LA is very sort of like, they aren't, like you just said, they're talking about the 405. They're talking about restaurants I've been to. They're talking about the LA experience that all the rest of us have. So you're not listening to some guy in the ivory tower. I mean, is that sort of local flavor something you find? Like, how much of that goes into your work?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, I've always thought radio is best when we serve sort of as like the town hall, where people can tune to you and sort of feel that community and that connection and know what's going on in the city around them. Pandora can't replicate that. Right. You can hear Katy Perry on Pandora, but local radio on a music station still kind of puts the music in context. You can figure out what's popular in your city and what other people are listening to and which big artist is coming to town. On a talk radio standpoint, you know, you talk about sports. I mean, but it's that sense, you know, what do human beings crave more than anything in life? Yeah, I would argue they crave connection to other human beings. Mm-hmm. And you can still very much get that in radio. If it's sports radio and you're talking about, you know, if you're a Broncos fan talking about how pissed you are that Peyton Manning didn't show up and just had his ninth, you know, one and done appearance in the playoffs, you can commiserate with other Broncos fans.
Yeah.
You know, when a city is under attack, like we were when I worked in Boston, people can go on, you know, when the people are brought to justice and celebrate as a city, and people calling in to thank law enforcement and people feeling safe and just that exuberance that happened. And you can't, like I said, I mean, you can't bottle that up on Pandora. And satellite radio, because they're talking nationally, can't connect with a specific community that way. And, you know, unfortunately, in the age of corporate radio, where there is more and more syndication and we've moved more to national platforms, we do risk losing that connection and that edge moving forward. But, you know, I feel very fortunate that I work for a smaller broadcasting company like Cox Media. That it's not about shareholders. And I mean, yes, we want to make money. We are a business, but we're not buried under debt. And we can still just do good broadcasting and serve the Tampa community every day.
Now, does something, and this may sound like a cynical kind of thing, but it's actually kind of not, is something that helps that local advertising? Because even, you know, like, you know, sure, you're going to say you want to sell Coca-Cola and Budweiser and whoever, but it still isn't so many local. I mean, if you're a local business in Tampa, in Moline, in wherever, I want to sell my business. I got three stores. I'm going to go to basic cable. I'm going to go to radio.
Yeah. You know, I will say this much, and this is sort of where the economics of the radio business got out of whack, because it was really in the late 90s and it was the end of the Clinton administration and it was a dot-com boom and everybody did the land grab. Yep. and paid 15 times cash flow on all these radio stations. And then the economy went south. And then, you know, after that, we start to see that there's other ways for a business to get themselves out there. Groupon became a thing. And, you know, some of those online sales where, you know, if you didn't want to go spend the money on TV spots, or if you didn't want to spend the money on radio, there were other ways you could get the word out there. So to some degree, I think that that affected the advertising market and is affected revenue to some degree on radio. But yes, I mean, it's still, we are a reach medium. I mean, 90% of Americans still use terrestrial radio every day. And on average, they listen for about 2 hours a day. That's less than it used to be. But that's still significant.
Yeah, that's a huge chunk of the day.
So it's still a great way to reach people.
So one of the things that was interesting is, like, you know, I can see, like, I think Pandora, it could probably be okay. And I think Spotify's doing okay. I think some of these things can coexist with terrestrial radio. But it is interesting to me that I don't think anybody would have predicted that people will still be, in 2015, yeah, I know we're only like 2 weeks in, but like you get the drift. People are still going to be discovering new music through radio over MTV, which gave up on new music ages ago.
Yeah.
That, I don't think anybody predicted that.
No, I mean, and again, you know, we talk about Pandora and Spotify, but you got to realize, you know, on the terrestrial radio side, yes, their competition in the threat that the same way Facebook and Twitter is competition. I mean, radio, mm-hmm. we're just competing for people's time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are distracted in more ways. But over there in that digital music space, there's more competition in that area because it used to be just Pandora. Then that begat iHeartRadio, which begat Spotify, which begat iTunes Radio because Apple is getting into that game. So those guys just have enough competition in their own space,
right,
for digital music. You know, over on the radio side, we're still competing with other radio. But, you know, is the proliferation of the smartphone happens and people are now more and more connected. And the next step of this, by the way, is going to be the connected dashboard in the car with Wi-Fi. You're going to have Wi-Fi right there in your car. The front console where your radio is will probably look a lot like your smartphone home screen in the next 2 to 3 years. And then that will be a bit of a game changer because now Pandora is just a button on an app right there in your car. And it's easier to access. But so is ESPN and, you know, streaming games online. And so is everything else. So really, you know, what I think is interesting in the overall media landscape is just the changing technology and how it's affected entertainment. I mean, in the TV world where you've spent time, the days of must-see TV on Thursday nights are done.
Long gone.
Nobody is sitting down and making that appointment to watch their favorite TV show at 8 p.m. on Thursday because, by God, that's when Seinfeld's coming on. People now just want that content when they want it.
Yeah.
And if it means recording it on DVR and watching it 3 days later, so be it. If it means binge-watching an entire season of a show that's 6 years old on your laptop, you can do that too.
We are becoming, our own TV programmers.
Yeah.
But I think, again, you point out a certain thing with radio, which is that when you look at the history of the medium, people were never only listening to music on the radio. There was an experience with the DJ, with that local flavor, calling in. Like, you know, even it sounds, I'm not trying to sound like country bumpkin simple about it, but there is something exciting, like 40 years ago, of like, oh my God, did you hear so-and-so was on the radio? She got on, you know what I mean? Like, that, there's a whole overall experience with radio that kind of truly hasn't changed. I mean, you're still doing call-ins. People still want to be on the radio. People still want to take part. And do you think that leg up, you know, I would argue that leg up is what's helping radio sort of survive over things like TV, which doesn't have that thing. You know, you just want to watch your shows whenever you want. I mean, the TV shows I'm watching right now are 35 years old. I'm pulling DVDs off my shelf to get used to old-time storytelling.
You know, you talk about radio. I mean, in the world that I've primarily worked in, and I oversee a variety of different formats right now, including a talk radio station.
Mm-hmm.
But my area of expertise through my career has been in Top 40 and working with younger formatted music stations. What you're seeing right now is that, I mean, young people in general don't pick up the phone to even call each other, Tim. Mm. I mean, everybody communicates through text. And how many times have you tried to call somebody on the phone and they don't answer, but then they text you 2 minutes later, hey, missed your call, what's up?
Yeah.
So really, you know, with us in the younger formatted stations, it's not necessarily about the calling in, but finding those other ways to communicate. And it's much easier to now, your request lines don't ring as much, but Twitter... Mm. You constantly have new Twitter notifications of people tweeting requests to you or interacting with your Facebook page or interacting with your Instagram accounts or interacting with Snapchat. And, you know, so that's the next level of all this is, yes, you're still connecting with your audience, but you're connecting in the space in which they want to connect with you.
Let me ask you about, because you've been all over, and I'm going to ask you for the audience to tell us your resume, because you're not just – Tampa's just the latest stop in a pretty varied career. You've been in Cleveland, Sacramento, or go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I was in an unusual position where I became a program director for radio straight out of college, mm-hmm. which usually never happens. It's something that you work up to over many years in your career, but I had to go to Augusta, Maine to actually start.
That's right.
And did a really small market radio there at a station called 92 Moose. That is not a lie. And then from there, I made the jump to Cleveland, and I was programming in Cleveland when I was, 23 years old. From Cleveland, I went to Miami. I was there briefly. I was in Sacramento for 6 years. I was in Boston for 2. And now I'm here in Tampa.
Okay, so is it a challenge to go from, you know, because we talk about the local communities and local connections, and you can't BS somebody, you know what I mean? Like, you can't bullshit somebody about their neighborhood. They're going to know it better. So is it what are the challenges of sort of bouncing around those places and getting people to, like, listen to you, trust you, and sort of accept you as a sort of neighborhood community voice?
Well, surrounding yourself with people who do know the area and mm-hmm. making sure you have some of them on staff. You know, it's interesting. When I launched AMP Radio in Boston, it was a brand-new format. We hired people all from outside the market to come be on the air. But, you know, you spend some time in Boston as well, and you get all those fucked up pronunciations of towns and suburbs. And it might be spelled Worcester, but it's Worcester.
Yeah, there's no Peabody.
It might be spelled Gloucester, but it's Gloucester. You know, and we had to put together an entire, like, Bible for the city of Boston for every air talent before they could even go on the air. And making sure that they knew those things, because you can't. If you're on there and you're trying to sound local, but you're mispronouncing suburbs, game over.
Yeah.
You know? Right. So it's funny how some of that gets lost in the age of what some companies are doing now with, like, voice tracking DJs into cities. It's not uncommon at iHeartMedia, formerly Clear Channel, to be listening to one of their radio stations, but the DJ talking on the air in Des Moines, Iowa, is actually from Seattle, Washington, and has never been in Des Moines. And, you know, the program director will try to send that local content to somebody, but you'll hear them mispronounce something or just say something the wrong way. And it slips through the cracks sometimes. But listeners can tell, and I think, you know, people know what their hometown radio station is. And, you know, that's just part of the challenge. I mean, when making sure we knew all those localisms when we put AMP Radio on the air in Boston, we were competing against a radio station that had been there for 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get people to sort of change a habit when they've grown up with something and when their parents grew up with something. But that's part of the battle, and that's part of what makes this fun, is going in and taking on a new challenge.
I remember Tony Schiavone plugging a Ric Flair signing at Natick, Massachusetts, at the mall.
Right.
What the hell is Natick, Tony? Oh, God bless. And they were Southern, WCW. Google it. Google it, kids, or ask your parents. A lot of people will say that, you know, public speaking is scarier than dying. But a DJ has to – that's the living, is public speaking. And quite frankly, I mean, listen to me. I'm making this up as I go along. I am not a trained DJ. I'm not a trained interviewer. I'm just having fun talking to people. But you have to – it's much more serious, you know, for you guys when you get in front of the microphone. Tell us about some of the challenges of being a DJ, a live talent, And how do you overcome any sort of fears or nervousness or getting in that zone?
I don't think anymore. I mean, there was a time in this industry back in the, you know, when our parents were growing up listening to the radio. It was all about having those deep pipes and, you know, having that deep voice and having a radio voice and, you know, kind of doing all that shtick. I don't think that matters anymore. I think it's about being authentic. I think the biggest challenge for air talent, and this is probably a challenge for people just in interpersonal communication, is realizing, you know, most people who get in and pursue being an air talent were always the class clown, or they like to be the center of attention. And there's that belief that whatever I'm saying must be the most important thing in the world right now. But it's not about communicating with people in the way you want to communicate with them. It's about communicating with people the way they need to be communicated to. Sometimes people just don't want to hear about all your long, long drawn out life stories. Sometimes they just want to hear about, you know, the concert that's coming to town, or who is this new artist that I don't know that you just played. If you are going to tell stories about your life on the air, hopefully you're doing it and sharing something that's just sort of like that, those commonalities, those universalities that people can listen to you talk. But when they tune on the radio, it's sort of like seeing their reflection in the mirror. And that's how people relate to you. I mean, Howard Stern, at the end of the day, like on a simplistic level, people go, well, Howard made a career by having porn stars on the radio and making them straddle a Sibian machine. Howard Stern made a career by being, I mean, he was one of the audience. He was a married guy who was really loyal to his wife and deeply loved his wife. Even though they didn't always get along sometimes, and she had to put up with all of his craziness in his work life, he went home and he was loyal to his wife and he had a kid. But at the same time, he spent his mornings surrounded by these insanely hot, slutty women. And there was always that temptation there that Howard just kind of wanted to bang a porn star. But you know what? You can't do it because you're married and you're a family man. And I think average people can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're that, you know, if you're that guy driving a truck listening to Howard, you know, Howard made hundreds of millions of dollars more than those people listening, but he never came across as being above them.
No,
you know, he's always one of them.
Yeah, no, sorry to step on you there. No, absolutely. And I listen to Howard a lot. And I know he's a divisive, controversial figure, but I listened to him a lot when I lived in Boston and stuff. He was a morning staple. And he really was, you know, regardless of what anybody thinks of some of those skets and how he pushed the edge and everything like that, there was a very common man element to everything he was doing. There was something very unpretentious. And that was not always the majority of his show. You know, I remember him talking about, he was like a big Deep Space Nine fan, I remember, and would like just be obsessed about this Star Trek show and was really, and like they would make fun of all the other people, like Jackie would make fun of him, like, what are you watching that for? And he's like, I love it. It's awesome. It's Star Trek, you know? And there's something about like when you listen to Howard Stern for a lot of the shows, and I think this speaks to that commonality, or it was almost like going to the local bar or the local coffee shop. Or something like that, you know.
The most successful radio shows I've ever heard, when listeners come up and talk to them, it's like, hey man, when I listen to your morning show, whoever it is, it doesn't have to be Howard, it could be, you know, a rock station in Savannah, Georgia. But if you can have that vibe where they feel like they're listening and they're just hanging out with friends, shooting the shit, and you know, then you've won. Because it's not about talking to the audience. It's about connecting with the audience. And I don't think every air talent gets that. There are some people who think it's all about them and they're very self-involved and it comes across very self-absorbed. Yeah. But those are typically the easy talents to spot because the ratings aren't very good and they're not as successful.
Now here's the tricky question, may not even be able to answer it, is that I imagine somebody's listening to this going, yeah, but how do I find those commonalities? How do I know I'm talking to them and not talking at them? Like, what are some of those differences? Like, do you ever catch yourself, for example, on the air going, oh, shoot, don't say that. You know what I mean? Like, how the proper way of addressing people.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, there's times, and especially now that I'm not on air full time anymore, and you're kind of, you know, you get back in and you haven't been on the air in 6 months, but you're on, you know, I'm on the air and sometimes I'll fill in. you know, it's a little harder to kind of get your sea legs again. But, you know, in terms of how do you know, you know, I think it helps just to be a curious person. I think it helps to care about the things that your audience cares about. And if you're not sure what that is, sometimes you just need to ask your audience. Yeah. And it's easier than ever right now to do that. I mean, in the age of social media, you know, Facebook is an instant focus group. In fact, when I was working in Boston, I had a group of about 30 listeners, all young women in the demo. They ranged from ages like 16 to maybe 28, 29. And they were just in a private group on Facebook. And a lot of times I would just float links to new music for them to listen to. And, you know, just solicit their feedback. Because you do reach a point where you realize, I'm not in this target demo anymore. You know, like, yeah. I'm not a young kid anymore, and I'm not going out to the clubs, and I'm not living this lifestyle, and I don't know, but it's my job. It's incumbent upon me to sort of have my finger on the pulse of what people are into and be able to convey that and broadcast that to the audience.
That's the perfect segue to my next question, which is really kind of the heart of what I want to talk to you about. For folks, I'm plugging your Twitter below and everything. Dan Mason is probably the most current, up-to-date, in-tune-with-pop-culture peer of mine, and it really is something I admire quite tremendously, and you've been a great example to me because I'm terrified of becoming the old guy who's saying, damn it, what is wrong with these kids today? I'm terrified of it. I'm terrified of being that guy that's looking down on these kids. You know, I just wrote a whole big thing about this Paul McCartney scandal.
Yeah.
12 people on Twitter ask about Paul McCartney, and all of a sudden the entire millennial generation is shot. And it's like, oh my God, you guys, we're trolling them. Stop it. Calm down. How do you, you know, you say it's your job, but at the same time, like, it's got to be, what are the challenges? And how do you stay so current? And is there ever a time where you're like, how do you not get, like, sort of lost in the, oh my God, who are these people? What are they doing? Because you post stuff on Twitter and Facebook, and I'm like, I have no idea what he's talking about. I have no clue
there's
what that is.
There's times I see things that you post on Facebook that I don't know about because, you know, I look at some of these things, like everybody talks about Orange is the New Black. Guess I've never watched it. Never watched it.
It's great.
You know, some of the, you know, Downton Abbey. It's great. You know, how many episodes of that do I need to watch to seem cool and cultured in front of my friends? I've never watched it. But you know, I would also argue, at least in the top 40 world, I don't have many listeners who are watching Downton Abbey either.
Right, sure.
It gets back into that being curious.
Yeah.
And wanting to know what other people are talking about. You know, I amassed so many Twitter followers in Boston from kids who just found me because they knew that I ran the radio station. But I would follow them back. I mean, it shows up in your timeline. You can see what music and what acts. Mm. And sometimes there's a brand new act that isn't being pushed by a record label. But all these kids are talking about it. You're like, well, I need to go research that. You know, TMZ is usual for the same reason some people get on CNN.com in the morning or the Huffington Post. I make a point early in the morning every day to log on to TMZ and kind of see what that new scandal is and try to find ways to incorporate that on the air into what we're doing and working that in. It used to be back in the day in Cleveland, and this was a different era of radio because they changed the methodology by which we get the ratings. But it used to be that people were just had to write you down in a diary, you know, for you to get credit for listening. So it wasn't really about just sort of doing the things minute by minute to keep people listening. As long as you were edgy enough and sort of top of mind that they would write you down, you would win. So we would always take those moments of pop culture and just do stupid shit on the air. I remember when we had Britney Spears at age 16 write a press release, or her people did, condemning my radio station in Cleveland. Because we went on the air and did a promotion called Body Like Britney, where we gave away your choice of plastic surgery. It was tummy tuck, lipo, or boob job. But by the time the media got through spinning it, we were being painted as these people that were telling 15-year-old girls they needed fake tits to be beautiful, right, which was not the promotion. It was geared toward moms, but we also went with it, and we did the controversy. When Kobe Bryant, within 24 hours of him being arrested and charged with rape, we were on the air sort of capitalizing, giving away a trip to stay at the resort in which Kobe Bryant allegedly did the deed, so you can go investigate. And it was the promotion was called Laker. I don't even know her. And it was just stupid. But people remembered it and people connected to it. And in this era of radio, we do that stuff a lot less. But, you know, I still look for those moments of pop culture and just try to work it into the fabric or the imaging of the radio station when we can. Or at least make sure that the jocks are sort of talking about it. If that's what the public's talking about, then that's what we should be talking about.
Well, I was quite privileged to be invited, and I believe I was a first round inductee into the Just Kick Justin Bieber in the Head challenge that you engaged in this past summer. But are you ever worried about? Well, one, I imagine every time you're going to push the envelope, you are going to have some people who say, no, I'm not going to listen to that anymore. So I know that risk is always there. But are you ever worried about, like, okay, like, so Britney Spears wants to have your radio station shut down. Then let's say 3 years later you're at a different radio station in Sacramento, and all of a sudden there's Britney Spears in your station as a guest. Or if Justin Bieber – I mean, like, is there any sort of that kind of, like – Well,
yeah, you know, I mean, you can always run that risk. And there are things that I do on my personal social media accounts that, you know, the Justin Bieber, you know, I guess for the sake of your audience, when the Ice Bucket Challenge was really all the rage, I started a movement on Facebook with the Kick Butt Justin Bieber in the Head Challenge with a Justin Bieber cardboard cutout to promote awareness for restless leg syndrome. Which was just more a funny bit and sort of a one-off for my social media followers. We didn't do that on the air. Mm-hmm. We have done other things on the air, you know, specifically related to artists. But, you know, if you're going to do something like that on the air, you have to know that there's always a chance there could be a backlash. And if Justin Bieber comes to town and doesn't want to deal with your radio station, that could be an option. But I don't think we've ever done anything that was more than like tongue in cheek. I don't think we've ever, you know.
Well, there is a sort of, this comes with the territory, celebrity. Let's just chill out. You know what I mean? I heard a story, I don't know if it's true, of Steven Seagal getting in Kevin Nealon's face backstage at Saturday Night Live. And it's like, are you kidding me? Dude, like, really? You're a celebrity. You're going to have to take some of this, you know?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, some people just take themselves entirely too seriously. And, oh, by the way, where's Steven Seagal at right now?
I have no idea. Yeah, please.
You know, I mean, the ones who get the big picture and know that it's good to be talked about, even if somebody's poking fun at you, are the ones who generally, you know, can look. On the flip side, there's Hugh Grant, who got busted with, you know, a crack whore on the Sunset Strip, but still went on and had a pretty good career and was able to laugh at himself about it when he did the interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of had to own that one and everything. I do want to point out for the record, though, that I also, when I did the Kick Justin Bieber in the Head challenge, I did put up the actual RLS.org website.
Yeah,
just in case somebody out there needed it. So,
well, that's one of the things I love about you, Tim. When there's a cause you believe in, absolutely, you get behind it, my friend.
Have you ever? Well, I'm just saying, it kind of sucks if you ever get kicked in the middle of the night. It's not a victimless condition. Actually, you're throwing out a lot of really interesting things here that actually pertain to the world of screenwriting. And let me just pull some for all the screenwriters out there. Like, why don't you talk to DJs? Because listen to some of the stuff Dan's talking about screenwriting. He's talking about connection with the audience. He's talking about being authentic. He's talking about finding those commonalities so that when somebody hears the material, they know exactly what's going on. And that sense of curiosity, always looking around, always trying to find interesting things, new material, and having your eyes open to new ways of thinking, because the marketplace is always changing. That's fantastic advice for screenwriters. If you try to bullshit your way through it, if you're not being authentic, if you're not curious, if you're too stuck in your ways, narrow-minded, everything, it's going to be a long sort of search for that first sale.
I'll throw this out there because I'm not a writer by trade, but I'm very interested in writing. And, you know, back in the days when MySpace was a thing, I had a blog that was very well received. And in fact, somebody pretty high up the entertainment food chain got a hold of my blog and paid me some great compliments about it. I went to go interview, actually, for somebody pretty high up the media food chain. But so writing is an interest of mine. And I just did a I just took a class in New York over New Year's weekend with a woman who would actually be an interesting guest for you. Her name is Susan Blackwell. She is a she's a Broadway performer, but she's actually written a show that was produced on Broadway, or she co-wrote it and performed in it. But it was one of the interesting things where, you know, we took this all-day writing workshop, and, you know, she'll throw out these topics, and you have to do the five-minute free write, and most of it all comes from your personal experience. And one of the things that's always kept me from really pursuing writing more as a side hobby is that sense of, God, what do I have to say? Like, why does anybody care about my life? Why does anybody care about things or challenges I went through at any point? But then when you kind of go around the room with total strangers and you start hearing people share, there would always be that head nodding. And you would, like, I was reading something and out loud you heard somebody who was just like, oh. And it is. It's that connection. But it's telling stories that might be true to you but are also true to the human condition and sort of the shared experience. Which is, I just think, is what, you know, the kind of the creative freedom, you know, that creative process and creative freedom for whatever avenue you're using to pursue it. I think that that's what it's all about.
I think that's absolutely right. And I love that story. And someone out there is waiting to hear somebody else's story. Somebody, there's people are out there waiting to hear these stories. That's absolutely 100% true. And the thing is, it's interesting you say that because I hear that a lot from people. It's like, why would anybody want to read one of my stories? Why should I say, why should anybody? There's no qualification. This whole idea of, like, you know, when you go and pick up a book at the bookstore, whether it be Amazon or an actual physical bookstore, very, very few book buyers actually look at the degree or qualifications of the person who wrote the book. It's all about the story and if it connects with them, usually pretty instantaneously.
Yeah. I mean, you know, God, like, you think of, like, Oscar-winning movies and, you know, like, Forrest Gump, at the end of the day, was just about somebody who wanted to matter in the world with limited capabilities and limited mental resources, just wanted to make a difference. And what's more universal than
that? No, absolutely right. Highly underrated Forrest Gump, actually. I know the one of the best picture, but it's not always as remembered, I think, as it should be. But one of the hardest things in the world of screenwriting and stuff is deadlines and everything. I'm actually writing to a deadline now, and I'm going to have to massage it a little bit.
Talking to some douchebag on the radio who plays Taylor Swift for a living.
We're going to talk about Taylor Swift. But one of the things that's always hard is writers are constantly complaining about deadlines, have to have it in. But in the world of radio, I mean, you guys, your deadlines are like right now. And I was wondering if we could just talk a little bit about being creative, being lively, and doing, you know, being interesting. And I know you say you don't write, but at the same time, like when you get behind that microphone, there is a, even though you have to get certain things in, whether it be, you know, bullet points with weather and news or whatever information you have about the preceding and proceeding songs, I'm making it sound drier than it is, but like there's still a creative element to it. And I was wondering if you could just talk about being a DJ and operating under such immediate deadlines.
I don't know. You know, for me, it's not, you know, there's no process. I don't think it's a gift. I think at the end of the day, creativity is just a way of operating. And you're constantly creating, you know, 24/7. I think you're, you know, you might not be creating art, but, you know, aren't we all, like, in a bigger sense? I mean, aren't we all just, like, sort of, you know, creating relationships? We're creating connection all the time, but there is a fair amount of writing also that goes into the job. At least in my radio stations, I do a fair amount of writing because it's those pop culture elements and trying to make sure that those get on the air. And then when Adele Dazeem happens and you want to poke fun at John Travolta in a promo, you got to get that on the next day, because if you wait a week to do the joke, the moment's already passed. So, you know, we've done, you know, whatever that stupid, dumbass pop culture moment is. For us, it's about getting it on the air the next day. When I was in Boston, the new Pope got elected. It was a huge Irish Catholic town. So you best believe we had little vignettes running on the air with the new Pope endorsing AMP radio. You know, it was Gregorian monks, you know, chanting borderline obscene lyrics that we might have been playing, you know, on the air at the time. But, you know, it's about living in the moment and really making sure that your brand for your radio station is about the present moment when you're working in Top 40. You know, Nike sells shoes, but they make the same shoe as everybody else. Nike is selling you their brand, which is athleticism, and these shoes will make you jump higher or run faster. Starbucks doesn't have better coffee than anybody else, but they sell you sort of the hoity-toityness and the cool factor of shopping at Starbucks. And for radio, you know, we need to have a brand also. In the Top 40 world, I've always found it to be helpful that our brand is right now. It is whatever's going on in the world, whether it be fashion, music, pop culture, celebrity arrest, or something, you know, more serious that truly affects people's lives. And, you know, in the case of something like the marathon bombing.
Okay, you're touching upon a super important topic in the world of screenwriting, and aspiring screenwriters really need to take note, maybe even rewind and listen to what Dan just said, because it's not talked about enough. The misconception about screenwriters is, and hold on, I'm going to come back to everything you just said, I want to expand on it, because the misconception about screenwriters, and I made this mistake about 8 years ago myself, which is, I'm going to write a little bit of everything so I could show people that I could write a little bit of everything. I'm going to have a horror, I'm going to have a comedy, I'm going to have a sci-fi, and then people are going to be like, oh my God, this guy can write everything, without realizing that all the gatekeepers, agents, managers, producers, they know every screenwriter can write everything. They don't want that. Nobody wants that. They want to know who you are. What is your genre? And another way to put that, quite frankly, and I think we should talk about in terms like this more in the world of screenwriting, is what is your brand? In other words, when I'm reading your script, what can I expect to get from you now on going forward? Because this is how I'm going to sell you in the marketplace. Your agents, your managers, your producers need to know and understand. When you say the word Judd Apatow or the name Judd Apatow, you know exactly what kind of movie you're going to get. When you say the Coen brothers, you know exactly what kind of movie you're going to get. Because and here's the good news about guys like that. You will find variety, but you're going to know and understand that brand. And we, an aspiring screenwriter, should not wait for Hollywood to do it. Do it now. Do it before they do it to you. And I think that's absolutely a vital, vital thing. And I'm so glad you mentioned that and some of those examples of, if you're a comedy writer, what kind of comedy? Black comedy, dark comedy, twisted comedy. I mean, there's within a genre, there's all these different things, and you need to sort of embrace that and understand it so that when you go in the marketplace, so that when somebody gets Dan Mason's resume or demo, they're going to know what they're going to get before they even listen to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when I hire morning shows, I'm in the process of hiring a morning show for my Top 40 station right now. And when I came in, one of my other stations I oversee is a sort of a male talk radio station, very similar to like what Howard Stern does, but we do it 24/7 with a variety of hosts. But one of the things that I usually ask when I talk to air talent, whether it be somebody that I'm just coming in and I'm going to be working with them for the first time, or somebody that I'm interviewing, and this goes more for the talk medium than just for a music DJ, but it's, what is your show about? You know, and you would be surprised, by the way, how many radio people can't answer that question, because they just, you know, there's some people that operate, oh, it's just about the wonder of me, and I just open up and say whatever comes to mind. No, you know, what is it about you that's going to make you stand out? What are you going to be known for? And I suppose that applies really to anything in the creative field.
Well, I think we're in the world of screenwriting. I know that a lot of writers get very sort of, you know, sometimes bashful, sometimes nervous, sometimes like, oh gosh, you know, here's, just please read my script. And it's like, no, why am I going to read your script? What's the script going to give me? And if I wanted to work with you, what are we going to be working on next after that? What else do you have in that bag of tricks, kind of thing? I think that's a great point. That's a great question to be able to answer, is like, you know, if somebody, if you get a meeting with an agent, if an agent or manager loves your script and you're lucky enough to get a meeting and you sit down and you have lunch, you're going to be nervous and terrified, trust me, no matter how much of an industry vet you are. But you don't ever want to say, I don't know, when they ask, what's your story and or what's your brand? You know, even if they change it, don't worry. You know, have an answer.
I also think that just on a deeper level, I mean, it's funny, you and I both went to Emerson College together at the same time. I actually started out in the theater program. And I started out wanting to perform and write, and I kind of got away from it. And after that first year in the acting program, I went to New York and I went to a couple of open auditions. And I realized that as an artist, like, you know, to put yourself out there, whether it's as an actor, a performer, or a writer, whatever it is, I didn't really know who I was at that age. And that made it hard for me to justify really going and pursuing sort of this artist life. Like, I think you need a strong sense of who you are. A, yes, because you're selling yourself to agents or directors or, you know, anybody, whether it be in Hollywood or on New York on stage. But you also need a strong sense of who you are to deal with the amount of rejection that you're going to get. You're getting doors slammed in your face all the time. And you got to have a thick enough skin and a belief in what it is you really want to do and what you're trying to accomplish to push through and not crumble.
Especially because some of that rejection should, and it's so hard, but like it shouldn't be taken personally. If, you know, I recently had an interaction with a prospective manager, and it was my mistake because I should not have even contacted this person because they basically emailed me and said, I don't touch material like this. And I was like, oh, shoot, I shouldn't. Sometimes it's not even personal. It's just literally like you are not what I'm looking for. You're not what I'm shopping for. You're not what I'm doing. And it's hard to take. It's a hard thing to swallow. But the right course of action is to find the people in the marketplace who are looking for you and are looking for the right thing. You know, one yes will absolutely wipe out 1,000 no's. But there, it's a hard way to get there. It's a hard thing to go through.
From the radio side, I've seen air talents who go on in one market and can't get off the ground. Like, it just doesn't work for that city. Their sense of humor, their sense of that personality doesn't work in that particular community. But then they can go somewhere else and shine and kill it in the numbers. But, you know, it's all circumstantial, and there's no one-size-fits-all for anything. I think in radio, we try to put everything into a neat box. Particularly as an industry, we gravitate more toward these national platforms and more syndication. You know, well, so-and-so show worked in this market. It's number one in New York City. You know, of course it'll work in Mobile, Alabama. The values and the beliefs of the people of Alabama are very different than the people in New York City.
You can't start your show, Go Obama. can't do that in every market. And you have to respect that, too. Like, even, you know, you have to understand that we do live in a very diverse country in many ways. And it's just not all not going to translate from one to the other. Good, bad, right, wrong. It's just the way it is. I'm going to ask you a question that I probably should have asked first, but hey, I bounce around on the show. How exactly does one program a radio station?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. Are you kidding? There's some days I leave the office and I wonder the same thing because the world is changing. And you know, if you look at just the way people are using radio and the technology is changing, but and I think the expectations are different if you're programming a top 40 station that's probably primarily geared. I mean, we'll throw out all these broad demographics like, well, we're targeting women 18 to 49. Yeah, like, well, really, the 18-year-old girl's got a whole different life and a whole different set of expectations than the 45-year-old mom. So, you know, but on top 40, I mean, I don't think I've ever really made a decision that wasn't hyper-focused on women 18 to 24 years old. And knowing that sometimes when you narrow the focus of what you're trying to do, you can get broad results. Because if you're focusing your programming to, say, like a 22-year-old woman in radio, you're going to get that 16-year-old girl that wishes she were 22 and old enough to get into the club and go get drunk and dance on the bar. And by the way, you're probably going to get that 45-year-old soccer mom because even though she's got two kids and she's got a job and she is tired at the end of the day, goddamn, she misses being 22 and out with her girlfriends and dancing on the bar. So, you know, it's interesting. In Sacramento, I mean, my radio station was number one, even with the women 25-54 demographic, on a station that musically should have no real business playing in that space. But at the end of the day, I think people want to feel informed and people want to feel like they're cool and they're hip and they're up to date on what's going on, even if they're not necessarily cool or hip or up to date. Everybody wants to feel like they are. So that's always worked really well for us. I mean, we use a lot of music research to gauge the music that we play and how often that we play it. We do a lot of focus grouping, or at least me personally. I'm always finding people in the audience and sort of running things up the flagpole to see what they think. And, you know, sometimes you just have to use gut involved too. But I don't, you know, I don't think that there's any manual on how to program radio. I think you just, you know, you want to be interesting and you want to be compelling and you want to be important in people's lives. And just not be that utility that's on in the background as sort of background noise that nobody pays attention to.
Yeah, I think that's a bigger another way to look at that is like I've seen and heard in the world of TV a bigger mistake of trying to be universal and we've got to appeal to everybody. And like, let's get these five demos. And it's like, oh my God, you guys, you're casting not even too wide a net. You're casting like a five-pronged net and you're not going to catch anything because you're not deciding. Again, it goes back to deciding your brand, who and what you are. Because of that 45-year-old soccer mom who maybe just in the car wants to pretend she is dancing on the bar, can listen to a few songs on the way to and from soccer practice or the mall or up the freeway or whatever it is she's doing.
I think also it's about, at the end of the day, like programming radio, I think it's about taking risks and trying new things and trying something new. Because if you're not really taking risks, you're static. By the way, the audience never stays static in radio. Right. Your ratings are either going up or they're going down. They usually don't stay flat for too long. But, you know, it's about taking risks and taking intelligent ones, not, you know, just doing dumb shit for the sake of doing it. I look for the parallels here because I know that this isn't a radio podcast. I know this is more about, you know, just about the creative process. But you look at these shows like Orange is the New Black that never would have been greenlit on network TV.
Yep.
But somebody took a risk and somebody put that out there. And I'll be damned if that isn't one of the more passionate shows that, you know, people talk about right now.
It's awesome too. I highly recommend it when you get a chance. But that's the thing. I think that's great advice in the world of creativity. And you just gave two right there. Take a risk and follow your gut. Like, there comes a moment, and I've noticed this with many writers who are like, I don't want to say wannabe writers, but folks who have never really attempted a screenplay or written something or blah, blah, blah. Like, oftentimes it's like they don't trust their gut and they can't even bring themselves to write like the first few pages. And they may have a great story, and it's like, look, sooner or later you just have to pull the trigger and start typing. And trust yourself and trust that gut and trust that thing and take risks. And because, quite frankly, there's not a ton of consequences to it. I mean, you've probably made a ton of decisions where you're like, I shouldn't have done that, should have done this. And that's, you live, you learn, and you keep getting better.
But you know? I'm also a big believer as a life approach that, you know, here's a story from my career.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
And this will sort of bring me to a bigger sort of life approach that's not about necessarily creativity, but about life.
Sure.
I told you I was programming radio right out of college at 21 years old. That never happens. Nobody becomes a PD that soon. And certainly nobody is programming a major market radio station in a market like Cleveland, which was a top 25 market at age 23. But I was always super focused and I was always the overachiever. And I had this goal that, by God, by the time I turned 30 years old, I was going to be working at one of three radio stations in America. And they were, at the time, the three most important that were out there for the kind of radio I did. It was Z100 in New York City. It was going to be Kiss FM in Los Angeles, or it was going to be Y100 in Miami. And 6 months before my 30th birthday, I got offered Y100 in Miami. And that was my dream job at the time. And it was everything that I had worked for. And I got there into the building. And by day four on the job, I said, A, this isn't what I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
B, I'm not really enjoying this. This is way more political, and it was sort of a political landmine I had walked into. And C, by the way, this isn't going to end well. And my dream job at Y100 in Miami, it turns out all the people that hired me there in the building were gone within the first 60 days of me getting there.
Wow.
New regime comes in, yeah. New bosses. They wanted to bring in their own guy. I was part of the old regime that sort of fell out of favor. My dream job at Y100 in Miami, I started there at the beginning of May of 2006. I was fired a week before Christmas 2006. The job lasted about 8 months. And at the time, it felt like the most devastating thing in my life. I had taken this huge risk, and I had left a job where I was enormously successful in Cleveland and could have stayed, you know, working for good people. And I went there, and it felt like I had failed. But I think sometimes when you put something out there and you give something a shot and you take a risk and it doesn't work, it's sort of life moving you in a different direction,
yeah.
And putting you on a different path and probably a better path. Because there are so many things that came into my life on that next move when I left Miami and moved to California. Things personally that happened for me, and kind of getting back to the idea of finding out who I really was and the things that I really liked that never would have happened if I didn't go to Miami and fall on my face. And by the way, it's not even that I fell on my face. I wasn't in the job long enough to fail. Yeah. I mean, it was really a circumstantial sort of thing. But, you know, go out there, take a bold chance. Go out and try something that makes you feel uncomfortable. And by the way, if it doesn't work out, always look for sort of the learning opportunity in it. And lurk for those points of growth, because I think that that's all you can do when you're in a challenge like that. You're going to get rejected. People are going to tell you they don't like your work, or people are going to tell you you suck at what you do. When I was fired from Miami, the new general manager who came in and sat me down and goes, well, let me tell you something. You don't have the experience. You're not battle tested enough for a city like this. You never should have been hired. And then he fired me. And the next job I went into, by the way, was a station in Sacramento that was probably the toughest job I'll ever have in my career. If you remember, there was a story years ago about a radio station where a listener had died in a water drinking contest that happened on the morning show.
That was Sacramento?
That was the station I went and took over in Sacramento, wow. And everybody got fired.
Wow.
Nobody in America wanted that job. And for some reason, I don't know. I mean, everybody told me not to take it, but there was just something within me that said, I can make this work. And I went out there on a 2-month consulting deal, was my original deal. And once I was there for 2 months, I said, I can make this work and I can turn this around. That was the station that was number one in every demographic a year and a half later. And I had a great 6-year run there at that radio station. So out of what seemed like the biggest failure of my life, came also the biggest professional success that I've ever had in my life. But I had to go through a really shitty 8 months to get there, you know?
But there's no avoiding those.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think sometimes we get so, like, caught up in, oh, gosh, what if this happens? What if that happens? Look, it's going to happen. I like how you just succinct. Like, people are, no matter what, no matter who you are, Vince Gilligan has been told he sucks. John Cleese has been told he sucks. You know, think of the smartest genius you know. They have been told you're terrible by somebody. And it hurt their feelings.
Conan O'Brien, Conan O'Brien almost didn't survive year one of late night.
Yeah.
The 12:30 spot, obviously.
Sure.
He didn't survive at 11:30, but he went on and became incredibly successful. But you got to ride that out, and you got to just, you know, sort of suck it up and push through. And do whatever the creative thing is that you kind of believe in, whatever that is for you, you know, whether it's writing, performing, you know, programming, radio, whatever.
Amen. I absolutely think that's a phenomenal story, and I thank you a million for sharing it. And you're right, because life does not ever work the way people have it planned out, you know. And one of the strangest quotes I remember just stuck with me for ages was, like, I remember an interview with Ozzy Osbourne, and they said, you know, how do you feel about this amazing career you've had? And he said, well, I'm very grateful, but I'll never make an album as good as Sgt. Pepper. And that always stuck with me. Because I'm like, wow, even Ozzy Osbourne is striving. You know what I mean? He's got one of the most enviable careers in the world of heavy metal. And he will tell you, I'm still striving to make it. You know what I mean? Like, we're all still striving. Everybody you know and admire is still striving.
And there's ups and downs throughout. It's absolutely funny, as we have this conversation, I look out of the corner of my eye and I see Michael Keaton accepting a Golden Globe for Birdman.
Yeah, talk about ups and downs, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's another one. I mean, how long was that dry spell? You know, Batman was in 1989, by the way. I mean, it's been a while.
Absolutely.
But you stick it out, and you take on the project that you believe in, and you fight for the role, or you fight for the project that you want to do, and you kind of will it to happen.
Only you can stop you. No one else can stop you. And I can tell stories. I don't want to name names, but I've seen a sabotage. I've had people try to steal my job on TV. Those stories are true. The backstabbers are out there. The abusive people are out there. But nobody can stop you but you.
This will all lead nicely to our next project, Tim, where you and I take on a life coaching podcast.
I'm ready. You know something, Dan Mason? People can do a lot worse.
Probably.
They could do a lot worse. Now, before we go, I know we're coming up on time here, but did you really break Taylor Swift's MTV Music Award?
God, I'd love to say that I really did, and I made BuzzFeed. I made BuzzFeed for it, but no, the story on that is I was one of maybe 20 program directors invited to a party at Taylor Swift's Manhattan apartment. Before she released this last album, she invited some program directors to her place to come drink wine in her apartment and come see her place and pose for pictures with her Grammy Awards. And it was a pretty cool event, but the VMA, as it turns out, was already broken. The head kept popping off.
Oh, okay.
So sort of as a joke, I'd asked her, can we pose this picture and stage it where it looks like I just broke your VMA? And she was very gracious. She did it. But then, of course, it caught on BuzzFeed. And then I started getting harassed by all these, like, Taylor Swift fans from around the world. Like, you're so disrespectful. She invited you to your home and broke her award. No publicity is bad publicity. I just went with it.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Oh, my gosh. I can only imagine your grin ear to ear from all these Taylor Swift fans were upset, and no usernames HTD Express were in that comment section. So
no, not at all. That was, I've had many great moments in social media involving celebrities, but that was one of my favorites.
Outstanding. I don't know. Do you want to get into your famous bands?
My famous what?
Being banned by people.
Banned by, blocked by Amanda Bynes.
Yeah.
That got started on a trip I made to LA, and I think it was right around the time that she was getting the consecutive DUIs.
Yeah.
So my sort of social media bit for the weekend became, well, people know I'm in LA. I'm just going to keep tweeting at Amanda Bynes like she and I are friends and that I'm going to hang out. So it'd be like, so I get on the ground and I'd be tweeting, you know, at Amanda Bynes, hey, boo, just landed at LAX. We're going and getting fucked up tonight, right? And then, like, of course, that led to, you know, the next morning, you know, hey, boo, oh, God, best sex ever that we had last night. Didn't even know you like white guys. And, you know, it was a series of those tweets. I'm sure she got those. She's like, who the fuck is this, block? And then there was the infamous.
Well, somebody read them.
Clearly. And then there was the infamous meltdown with Michael Lowen, where we got into a Twitter war one night. Which started because Michael Lowen, I guess JetBlue had lost his baggage on a flight, and my entire news feed, which, A, why the fuck do I even follow Michael Lowen on Twitter? I don't have the answer to that. But my entire news feed was nothing but tweets of Michael Lowen blowing up JetBlue, just so angry that they lost his bags and nobody was taking care of him. So I just sort of casually responded to everyone. So it was at Michael Lowen, at JetBlue. Hey, don't worry, JetBlue. I'm sure you're, in the grand scheme of things, you're the least of Michael Lowen's problems. Kind of a flippant comment. Didn't expect Michael Lowen would be there literally within a minute. Michael Lowen just starts blowing me up and melting down on me on Twitter. And then it ended up becoming a two-hour affair that included JetBlue actually getting involved to tell me that they appreciated my support, by the way. But, you know, Michael Lowen's like, I'm going to block you. But then he kept tweeting me. So very calmly, I just would respond back, sir, you said you blocked me. Why do you keep tweeting at me? Like, is this how you treated? Is this how you treated Lindsay? Is this why she's a drug addict now? You know, hashtag daddy issues. And it just got out of control. It was it was a fun night over a couple glasses of wine at the Casa del Mason.
Wasn't that around Christmas time too? Like, wasn't it holiday travel?
It might have been, but
I don't even remember. I want to say it was around Christmas. For whatever reason, that story and Christmas are very close together in my memory. but see, there's also something kind of stupid about the responding thing. Like, actually, I think Amanda Bynes' strategy is much better. If you're getting, tweets you don't like, because celebrities have to deal with a lot of this kind of thing, just don't even, why? Just don't do it. Just block. Forget about it. But Michael Lohan, what are you doing, man? Battle the wills with people.
I'm not that type to be a troll, by the way, on celebrities. Like, it's not useful. I mean, at the end of the day, they shouldn't give a shit about my opinion. But then in the case of Michael Lohan, you know, when you get into like the lowest life forms, you know, that exist and walk among us, he's up there at the top of the list. Just in terms of being famous for doing nothing but being a really shitty dad.
And a shady character all around. I don't do a lot of criticizing of celebrities and stuff on this show, but I don't mind saying shady character. Michael Lowen, sorry, dude. But I hope you get well, and I hope you find some help and peace in this world, Michael. If you're listening, good luck.
And
to you.
Hopefully, JetBlue found your luggage.
I hope so too. Yeah. So, all right. Well, Dan, that's a fun little note to end on. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time and really opening up and sharing some just really cool, intimate, and very, very useful reminders and tips and some great advice for everybody out there who's in the creative arts, screenwriters especially.
Hey, at Twitter, I'm easy to find, at Dan Mason Tweets. Would love to, you know, kind of continue the conversation with anybody online. I love meeting creative types of all sorts. This has been great. This has been awesome. Thanks for talking to me.
No, thanks a million. And hey, Susan Blackwell's got an open invitation. Anytime she wants to come on, I'd be delighted to have somebody from that scene come on. That'd be fantastic. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening, tweeting, downloading, sharing. Please keep spreading the word. We got lots of fun stuff coming up in the new year. And yes, wrestling fans, there will be some wrestling shows coming soon. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.